to say as well too, for us, for Michael and I, working for the BFI festivals, and we were at the European premiere for Moonlight, and it was such a thrill to see that film and discover exactly what Michael's been saying about a new voice, a perspective that you don't often see in cinema by such a gifted filmmaker.
And Moonlight's a particularly interesting example now when we're talking about BFI Flair, because we made a decision that we were going to include Moonlight in our programme, even though it's already had a theatrical release. We knew that our audiences would want the opportunity to come and see the film at the film festival, at BFI Flair, in a cinema full of like-minded people that would appreciate the nuances, that would laugh at the right moments, that would cry at the right moments. And I think there is something about that shared experience and about that experience of watching a film in a cinema full of queer people that is so exciting, and isn't something that you can always easily get when you're watching something within a kind of mainstream cinema. So for us, it was a very important film to include in the festival, and audiences really responded to it, and it sold a lot of tickets straight away, yeah. Which was amazing considering it's a film that they could just go and see at their local cinema.
The success of Moonlight has got many of us rethinking the way we see sex and race depicted on the screen. We'll find out how the British Film Institute plans to capitalise on the Best Picture winner with this year's BFI Flair Festival. That's coming up today on The Cinema Show. Also ahead.
Period is actually the best period in the history of Hollywood cinema. They will tell you a story in 70 minutes that nowadays they would maybe devote a whole miniseries to.
We'll visit a new retrospective at Vienna's Film Museum that recalls how censorship changed the nature of filmmaking. And perhaps no one felt that rapid shift more than Mae West.
You were wonderful tonight.
I'm always wonderful at night.
That's all to come on The Cinema Show on Monocle 24.
I think when you see what's happening with television and queer characters, LGBT characters on television, you could definitely see that happening. It's really exciting. It's like exploding right now. You have queer characters who are part of so many different mainstream television shows. You have a show called like Transparent, which is just queer in its very nature, formally quite queer and unusual and boundary breaking. So I think cinema is going to follow that definitely.
That's Tricia Tuttle, one of the directors of London's BFI Flair Festival. Alongside programmer Michael Blythe, the pair are responsible for assembling a list of some of the most fascinating films in the LGBT world. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. After the stunning awarding of Moonlight as Best Picture at the 89th Academy Awards, queer cinema seems to be in quite a good place. For years, LGBT films have told the stories of angst and trauma that often comes with the classic coming out story, something which Moonlight managed to avoid. So is queer cinema at a turning point, or are we already in a post-coming out age?
And it's something I've heard Michael and the programmer say, that that sort of coming of age story will always have a place in a film festival. And I think audiences are interested in it. There are always going to be new people thinking about themselves, new young people coming to the festival and thinking about their lives and wanting to see cinema that reflects those lives. So I don't think that's going to go away.
Absolutely. And I think you do find that a lot of the films in the festival might seem like they take on traditional coming out or coming of age narratives, but do something slightly different with them. We have a film in this year's programme called Dear Dad, which is a film from India, which is a coming out story, but it's actually about a father coming out to his teenage son. On the other hand, we have a film called Handsome Devil, which is a really great Irish comedy. And at the centre of the film is a young boy at boarding school. And you might think it's going to be a coming out tale or a tale of the boy falling in love with his roommate. But actually, it's not. He's gay. He's comfortable with that. The people around him might not be, but he's very sure of himself and who he is as a young man. And the relationship that he builds with his new hunky roommate is actually just a very close friendship. So I think queer cinema and the films that we have in this year's programme still have ways of surprising us, even if we think they're going to give us what we might expect.
Everyone at Woodhill College was obsessed with rugby, and I didn't hate rugby. But what happened if you didn't love it?
I think there are two other films about young people as well that I'd highlight. So there's one, 54, which is Jan England's film. It's a Canadian film, which is about bullying in high school. It's not a coming out film, but it's about young people and their experience of, you know, having to deal with how other people perceive their sexuality. There's also, it's much more obliquely about that, but there's Being 17, which is the André Téchiné film, which is in the festival, which Céline Sciamma wrote, which is about two young people who are thrown together and find they have an intense love-hate relationship, which is so truthful about the experience of being 17 and feeling hate and desire all in one untidy package.
Another thing that's very important for us in the festival is that while we have many stories of coming of age, coming out, stories that we might have seen before and stories that are told again in different ways, it's very important that we recognise that not everyone across the world is in the same position. Moonlight's been a huge step forward in terms of LGBT and black visibility, in terms of mainstream cinema and in terms of films that can win awards. But we have a scheme within the festival which is called Five Films for Freedom, which is so important to us, and it's something that we work on with the British Council. And what we do is we take five short films that are screening in the festival, and for the duration of the time that the festival runs, we make them available globally, free to watch online. And it's important to us that a lot of the countries that you can then access these films in are countries where homosexuality is still illegal, where it's punishable in criminal law. So for us, it's important that we recognise that we're making big steps in many ways. And in many ways, the films that you have access to tell us a seemingly different story about the world that we live in. But that's not the case everywhere.
Tricia Tuttle and Michael Blythe. Now, have you ever wondered where film festivals find all those movies? It's an enormous task that often takes the form of full-time film watching. Tricia and Michael will explain how it all works a little bit later in the show. Cinema has certainly come a very long way since silent movies gave way to the talking era. In the year that PricewaterhouseCoopers first took over the voting process at the Academy Awards, Frank Capra became the first filmmaker to sweep all the major categories with the romantic comedy It Happened One Night. That was also the year that censorship really took over the screen. Up until then, films such as Footlight Parade had subtly alluded to gay characters, and adultery could be used as a plot point. In retrospect, the so-called pre-code years feel a lot like a breath of fresh air, and that's certainly the view of the organisers of a special curation at Vienna's Film Museum. The lineup focuses on eight filmmakers who took advantage of the permissiveness and artistic freedom of the early 1930s. The retrospective is called Lubitsch, Sternberg & Co. And our man in Vienna, Alexei Korolev, went along for a look.
As Hollywood made the move from silent to sound in the late 1920s and early 30s, a group of pioneer filmmakers emerged to test the boundaries of the new medium. They didn't have much time. In 1934, at the behest of powerful Hollywood manager William Harrison Hayes, a rigorous moral code was introduced that severely limited the kind of language and subject matter allowed on screen. A kiss, for instance, could last for no more than 7 meters of film. Adultery and murder were to be portrayed in a bad light, and God forbid if you ridiculed clergymen. But the brief period between 1930 and 1934 saw an outpouring of films that explored the as-yet-unrestricted cinematic freedom. Films like Raoul Walsh's The Bowery, made in 1933.
Get your mind off the skoits. They're worse than the booze is. They fill you full of hot air and all they want is your spandulics. Remember what I always tell you? This is a man's world. This is a man's world.
Pre-code American cinema is the subject of a current retrospective at Vienna's Film Museum, and I talked to one of its curators, Christoph Huber.
It's actually already the second part of a bigger project that the Film Museum is doing, which is devoted to the so-called pre-cold cinema. That's American early sound cinema until 1934, before the so-called Hays Code, which introduced the self-censorship of Hollywood, basically was brought in because back then in the 30s, cinema was seen as something that would loosen the morals of the people with the bad examples and so on. But of course, now when you look back at it, it's the other way around. These films seem very fresh because they are not submitted, at least not submitted directly, to self-censorship. So there's very open talk about sex, there will be criminal deeds that go unpunished, all those kind of things that would become impossible for maybe then 30, 40 years in American cinema from 1934 onward. That's one of the things why the films are so modern, actually. But I think another reason is that early sound cinema, which always is described as very stagey, and in the beginning they did not know how to move the camera and so on, this applies to a few films at the beginning of the period, but actually very soon they figured it out how to do it really quickly. And I think that period is actually the best period in the history of Hollywood cinema, because when you look at it, they will tell you a story in 70 minutes that nowadays they would maybe devote a whole miniseries to, you know, and it would take them like 6 or 7 hours. So these films would be really fast. They have this sharp, edgy, quick clip dialogue, which is amazing. But they also have a way of showing the world, and actually it's this era, like late 20s, early 30s, which is a very important period for urbanity and for modernity. This translates very directly, I think, into the films. And so the Film Museum has this project going of showcasing pre-cold cinemas from different angles. We had a first part already last May, which was devoted solely to one studio, Warner Brothers, which is in many ways the most amazing studios of the period, because this pre-cold film spirit, this energy, this rawness comes through strongest with them. And now the second part is actually looking at what you call the auteur directors of the period. So, of course, with Lubitsch and Josef von Sternberg, we have the two famous, most famous ones in the title. But there are, of course, other figures who, right at this period, are somehow inspired to make something special. I mean, of course, Lubitsch, Sternberg, or others that we have chosen, like Raoul Walsh or Frank Borzage, they made great films throughout their whole career. But in this period, something very special comes out. Let's take the example of Frank Borzage, a filmmaker who is famous for his transcendent and very intense romantic tales, which sometimes could be almost abstract in the glorification of an ideal love. But during that period in the 30s, which is of course also the time of depression in America, he makes films that are very strongly connected to social reality. So you have this element of Borzagian idealism, but you also have very realistic and very moving portraits of what it's like to live in those times for people who have no money. One of the most beautiful films, I think, of that era and of Hollywood in general, it's called Man's Castle. And it's a love story between Spencer Tracy, who meets a girl basically, well, in some housing development, almost like a slum. Yeah. But through their love, they kind of manage to transform, you know, the dilapidated settings into something beautiful and something transcendentally romantic. So there's this very special angle that comes out in this period. And another director we have in there, I mention him because he's like the only true pre-cold only director. It's a guy called Rowland Brown, who only made 3 films exactly in that time between 1931 and 1933. And those films, they have been rediscovered and celebrated by famous people like Martin Scorsese, for instance. In those 3 films, he has a totally modern and astonishing outlook at the way that crime influences society. So basically, those are crime stories. One of them is actually a prison tale, but the other 2 are stories about gangsters. And what he brings out very strongly is that the gangsters are not standing apart. You have these criminal people and then there is good society. But no, there are always corrupt businessmen, corrupt politicians and so on, who enable the gangsterism, actually. So it's really also the story how in this time of prohibition and between wars, something like organized crime really took shape. These films are unique. They are very, very rare to see. I think we are playing them for the first time since 31 years, when there was another pre-code show here, actually 21 years, sorry, it was 1996. And they are screening very rarely worldwide, actually. only very few prints are left. They have never come out on DVD, so this is something truly unique and special, for instance, and one of the reasons why we want to do that kind of show.
What do people coming here to see these films, what will they take home with them?
Well, for one thing, I hope lots of happiness, because these are very beautiful films, and also, of course, what we are doing, and which is something that not many cinematheques are doing anymore worldwide, is we are only showing those films on original film prints. You won't have a digital screening at our place. Films are meant to be shown on film, because film itself is a 35mm copy, and in projection, the way the light goes through it is a unique artifact, and no matter how good a digital approximation of it is, it can never be exactly the same as the original film artwork. It would be like going to a gallery and instead of seeing like the original painting, you would just see a digital screen, you know, with the artwork maybe perfectly reproduced, but still you couldn't see the layers of colors and so on. And the same is true for films. But I think what these people also can discover when they look at these supposed old and stodgy movies is that these movies are much more modern, much more open in the way they portray the world, in the way they explore the world, than many of the newest films. And actually they project something about how cinema really has explored the world that is still fresh and modern and that you can keep rediscovering. And you may find out, at least that is my thesis, that the cinema of the early 30s is actually maybe the fastest, the quickest, the funniest, the most moving that has ever existed.
He's a man, ain't he?
Oh, yes.
Well, that's all I gotta know.
Well, what I mean to say is... he's the
that was Monocle's Alexei Korolev speaking to Christoph Huber of the Film Museum in Vienna about the retrospective Lubitsch, Sternberg & Co. That's running until the 9th of March. The rise of censorship hit Hollywood with a mighty thud, and looking back at films of that era, it's easy to trace the impact.
I had said, no, Ted, I'm afraid I may meet the women that you've known.
The 1930 film, The Divorcee, sees Norma Shearer discovering that her husband has been seeing another woman. She seeks revenge by starting an affair of her own with his best friend. But after all the secrets are revealed, she launches herself into a furious tirade against the hypocritical expectations placed upon women.
And I thought your heart was breaking like mine. But instead you tell me your man's pride can't stand the gas.
Now wait a minute, Jerry, listen.
Oh, I don't want to listen. I'm glad I've discovered there's more than one man in the world while I'm young and they want me. Believe me, I'm not missing anything from now on.
I don't doubt it. Once a woman throws down her fences...
Oh, pin it on a motto and hang it where Janice can see it.
Stop that.
Oh, loose women, great, but not in the home, eh, Ted?
Cut it, do you hear?
The looser they are, the more they get. The best in the world, no responsibility. Well, my dear, I'm going to find out how they do it. So look for me in the future where the primroses grow. And pack your man's pride with the rest. And from now on, you're the only man in the world that my door is closed to.
The majority of films we now call classics were made from around the late 1930s onwards. That's perhaps why we're often shocked to find that, contrary to our collective views of the past, attitudes of the early 1930s were actually far more liberal than we might imagine. But when censorship finally did arrive in Hollywood, perhaps no one felt it more than Mae West.
Well, when I'm good, I'm very good. But when I'm bad, I'm better.
Born in Brooklyn in the 1890s, West got her first taste for performance at the age of five while, ironically, entertaining church crowds. Her mother adored her enthusiasm, but the rest of West's family weren't so impressed. As she would prove later in her career, however, the approval of others was never high on Mae's agenda. By the mid-1920s, Mae West was writing and starring in her own Broadway productions. Her first play, titled Sex, was decimated by critics. But the ticket sales, well, they did not stop. Until a series of complaints by religious groups resulted in a police raid, and West, along with the rest of the cast, were arrested. She could have easily paid the fine and gone home to sleep in her own bed that night, but while some might have seen the scandal as a financial disaster, Mae West sniffed a prime opportunity for publicity. In jail for corrupting the morals of youth, West apparently spent the time having dinner with a prison warden and his wife. She later told one reporter that while the other girls inside were forced to wear a terribly unglamorous garment known as a burlap, she had worn silk panties.
What's a good at resisting temptation? There'll always be more.
What might have ended the career of just about anyone else only helped make Mae West a sensation. Her next play, titled The Drag, was inspired by several of West's male friends who were desperate to step out of the closet and live an openly gay lifestyle. The play ran at a few theatres outside of New York, but despite West's efforts, never made it to Broadway, largely due to a fierce objection from a bizarre organisation known as the New York Society for the Suppressment of Vice. Mae West continued to write and star in a series of productions, all of which ignited controversy, until one of her shows, Diamond Lil, became a major hit. The 1928 play told the story of a wisecracking, possibly promiscuous young woman, who also happens to be very smart.
Well, it's better to be looked over than overlooked.
Great town, St. Louis. You were born there?
Yes.
What part?
Why, all of me.
That would remain a running theme through much of Mae's work as she jumped from stage to screen at Paramount. Her most successful film, I'm No Angel, paired her with Cary Grant in another self-penned story. By 1933, Mae West was one of the top box office stars in the world. But storm clouds were gathering, and the new wave of heavy censorship was rolling in fast.
The code sets up high standards of performance for motion picture producers. You want entertainment, wholesome, interesting, and vital.
In response to the strict requirements of the Hays Code, as enforced by Will Hays, West attempted to distract censors by deliberately inserting ridiculously outrageous lines, knowing that they would be cut, in the hope that other lines would be seen as less severe. It didn't quite work. By the late 1930s, West's films notably lacked the quick wit and acid tongue edge that had made her famous. A campaign against her public persona, led by William Randolph Hearst's newspaper conglomerate, also took its toll. After moving from Paramount to Universal and then Columbia, West took a role in the 1943 film The Heat's On, but by now, censorship had almost completely eliminated any hint of innuendo in Hollywood cinema. Even the necklines on West's outfits had to be raised. With her screen persona all but destroyed, Mae West wouldn't make another film for 27 years.
Young lady, are you trying to show contempt for this court?
No, I'm doing my best to hide it.
But it was far from the end of her career. Her later years included record-breaking roles on Broadway, in various nightclubs, and even a triumphant return to the screen with 1970's Myra Breckinridge. Vanity Fair affectionately described West as the greatest female impersonator of all time. After her death at the age of 87, the New York Times recalled her trademark sachet on 5-inch stiletto heels. She purred witticisms that evoked both the atmosphere of the bawdy house and the raucous laughter of the honky-tonk.
You once did a play on Broadway with a lot of female impersonators
in
it.
Yeah, The Drag.
The Drag. Well, it was considered quite shocking at the time.
To me and asked me to please do not bring that play into New York. I glorified the homosexual.
The homosexuals are particularly fond of you. Why is that?
Oh, they are. Well, they know what I was doing for them, you know.
A clip of Dick Cavett's interview with Mae West as part of a special that aired on CBS in 1976. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. Still to come, we'll discover the secrets of assembling a film festival. Stay tuned. Last month saw the passing of one of Japan's most admired filmmakers. Seijun Suzuki was known for his eye-popping way with colour and fondness for entertainment, even at the expense of logic. With Tokyo Drifter in 1966, Suzuki told the story of a former gang member forced into a life on the run when his old friends set out to kill him. The following year, he made Branded to Kill, a film that's as fascinating as it is notorious. Adored by fans and often considered a classic today, it received such a walloping upon its release that Suzuki stayed away from the director's chair for the next 10 years, while launching a lawsuit that destroyed the film's production studio. Branded to Kill is one of the films playing on Mubi right now here in the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, Mubi's very own Discoveries series continues with the worldwide release of Silvered Water, Syria Self-Portrait. This astonishing documentary was shot by more than 1,000 Syrian civilians and premiered at the Cannes Film Festival in 2014. Mubi is the curated movie site of cult, classic, and award-winning cinema. Catch a whole month for free right now. Just head over to mubi.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. The 31st edition of the BFI Flare Film Festival takes off here in London from the 16th of March. Trisha Tuttle and Michael Blythe are still with me. Now, as the host of this show, I obviously need to watch a lot of movies, but I suspect nowhere near as many as the both of you. How do you both handle what must be that sheer volume of content that stares down at you and somehow filter that into some kind of orderly program?
Myself and the programs I work with, we'll travel around and we'll go to different festivals, we'll watch different work, we'll meet different filmmakers, we'll talk to programmers from other festivals, and we'll get a sense of the work that's being made that year, what's being programmed elsewhere. And then from there, we will go on and do our own kind of more specific research. And like I said, we will have a open submission policy where we call in work. We'll do a kind of call out for queer filmmakers to submit their films to us. Essentially for us, the idea is to watch as much stuff as we can get access to. And as you said, sometimes the quality of the work that we look at can be wildly different. But I think that's something that's so exciting about this job. And I think it's something that makes, when you find those special films, when you find a film that speaks to you or that you think does something different or represents a different type of audience, it's so exciting for us.
Yeah, I would totally echo what Michael is saying, that I think one of the exciting things about programming the festivals, we run BFI Flare and we run London Film Festival as well, and that sense of discovery, you know, of course you do see work which is not as strong, but when you see something that is genuinely unknown to you and you watch it and you hear a new filmmaker's voice or you see a perspective, a human perspective that you haven't seen before, that's so exciting. So it's really, I think anyone who programs a festival is really privileged to do that. And if you don't enjoy that process of discovery, then probably not the right job.
Absolutely. And I think there is something as well that's important for us to look at when we're viewing submissions and when we're looking at work, is that different work is made under different circumstances. People have different access, people have different opportunities when they're making work. So you have to look at things with different eyes. Sometimes you might have something that's a little bit rough around the edges, but it's saying something really interesting. It's representing someone that might not always be represented in cinema. And I think our audiences are very smart at watching work that, like I said, may be a little rough around the edges, but seeing why we've programmed it and why we think it's an important film to show. I think it's important for us that by showcasing work like this, it can make the way for more films like it to be made.
That was Michael Blythe and Trisha Tuttle. The BFI Flare Festival celebrating LGBT films kicks off from the 16th of March right here in London. Tickets are on sale now. That's it for today. Next week, as Isabelle Huppert's Oscar-nominated performance in Elle hits theatres, we'll examine the bizarre psychosexual drama alongside an even stranger new title, The Love Witch. Today's show was edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffin. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your audio. And we'll leave you now with a track from the landmark queer documentary, Paris is Burning. RuPaul fans will know about this one. It was also voted by the BFI as the fifth greatest LGBT film. This is Malcolm McLaren with Deep in Vogue. The Cinema Show returns next week. I'm Ben Rylan. Thank you for listening. Deep.